Okay, I'm just gonna start this podcast like this, Woody Woodcock.
Love that.
I'm thrilled to be next to you today.
I am also thrilled to be next to you.
But I'm also scared because I've got an announcement to make.
Okay.
Right here, right now.
Okay.
We're finishing this podcast series.
Oh yeah.
That's right.
You were waiting for me to do the sound effects.
No.
I was like, I'm actually doing it.
No. It was perfect silence. I'm glad you lent in with me there. We're finishing the series at nearly 70 episodes. I'm saying nearly because you've got a couple more to go in New York. 70 episodes is a lot. That's a lot of episodes. That's over, I believe it's 123 hours of humans speaking about stuff.
Yeah.
And I want to use this episode to reflect on... Where were we? Why did we start this podcast originally? What have we learned? And we can't recall every single episode, but what stayed with us since recording those episodes over the last 2 years? So what have we learned? And then, most excitingly, what is next? Because we have a plan, and we have somebody that you can't see on the camera right now that's listening to us intently, Nat. And we're going to be moving into the future of unknown, as we always do. With episode and series two, just series two. So before we do that, before we move into what's coming next, I wanted to start with, like, why did we start this podcast? And where did the idea come from? So we started Untalented because we saw so many podcasts out there in the world, particularly, like, you know, these big scary podcasts with these big scary guests, making them kind of sound big and scary. And I thought, it's funny, in the creative industry, I think it's one of the most inaccessible industries, despite being one of the most required to be diverse. And yet, so we have all these really senior, big, scary people, and no one ever speaks to them and understands them as a human being.
Mm.
You do have podcasts with them on, but they sound like gurus.
I think also we were having loads of really rich conversations with some of the most incredible creative leaders and non-creative leaders, people doing the work.
Mm.
And we held a lot of that information for ourselves and we're sharing it in conversation, but I think it needed to be amplified on like a different scale.
100%. If there's 10 of us, there are 10 or 15 or 18 of us, whatever that is, having five conversations a day, it's over 1,000 conversations in a month that would just be in a Zoom call or in a coffee shop and it wouldn't go anywhere. So like, yeah, that we felt like that and we thought, well, hold on, we have so many amazing contacts and connections. Why don't we bring them onto this podcast and make them sound untalented, which was the idea, right? Let's make them feel comfortable. Let's ask them questions that maybe people wouldn't ask these people and make them sound as human as possible. And therefore, that was what birthed Untalented. So we went out, we met with over 67 or 70 different people. They could have been influencer marketing agency owners. They could have been designers that nobody had heard of. They could have been creative Adland exec network CEO. An author, whatever. If somebody was working and using creativity to realize a commercial gain for themselves or for other people, we wanted to hear from them how they did that and where they're going next. So I feel a sense of like completion in that I think we've offered a variety of diverse voices. Where I feel like we've maybe not delivered is in executing that information and making sure that lives and breathes on all of the different platforms and places that people are consuming.
Yeah.
I think long form content is great, particularly for deeper conversations, particularly for our niche of people that want to get to know those people. But not everyone is sitting there with an hour and a half worth of time processing all of that information.
Yeah. And I think the most interaction and conversation that we were getting through our socials and, you know, people we met was via the short form content that we were creating.
Yes.
Because there was some gold in there that's been missed that I'd love to see come back out again and because again, we're still holding some of that information when people haven't accessed the long form.
Yeah.
And the same is happening that was happening previously when we were having these conversations, but no one was getting to benefit from it.
Totally. And so that leads us nicely into, I'm going to say, like, the timeless pieces of advice, because some of the podcasts that we've recorded have been quite trend focused. you know, we'd speak about Brat Summer and that would have aged really badly in, you know, 2 months' time. So that the timeless pieces of advice that we've picked up over the last 2 years, I'm going to start. So I have five, you have five. Mm-hmm. And we're going to do this thing where you say to me the number one and I say your number one.
Okay,
and then we're
going to
go through.
One, one, two,
oh,
two,
you
two,
better two. Believe it, sister.
All right, love that.
Mm-hmm.
Love that.
Uh-huh. All right, so I'm going to start with you, Woods.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, no, you're going to start with me.
Okay.
Right. What was my first one?
Your first learning is from Sarah Tate.
Indeed.
So Sarah taught you the importance of aligning culture with the words that you say versus the actions you take.
People call it lots of different things: cultural transformation, internal transformation, people-based transformation. For me, it's internal behavior change. How do you get the people within a business, which, let's be honest, are the business, to think, feel, and do the things they need to think, feel, and do in order to help the business be successful? So quite often it's embedding a vision, quite often it's embedding a strategy. And that could be marketing transformation, so for a huge marketing discipline, or it could be all company transformation. So, and for me, it's very close to, very aligned with strategic work I used to do when I was younger, which is, why do people do what they do, and why don't they do some other things that you want them to do?
Absolutely. So Sarah Tate, 21st century brand, used to be the CEO of TWA. What she taught me in that, after writing a book called Rebuilders, is that loads of agencies, loads of brands, loads of businesses will put these words on a wall and they'll hope that change is going to happen within the business. I was guilty of doing that. I wrote, you know, I used to write our principles out. Remember, there'd be like fucking 10 commandments of me, like,
I think we had like 25 at one point.
25 commandments, and like, can you all remember those, please? Yeah. And you must be living by them.
Yeah.
And the thing that Sarah taught me was, you can have all of those values and they're really important, but you know what's even more important to those values? The behaviors of people. You can only really change culture by changing behaviors. And those behaviors are micro behaviors. They're tiny things that people do that ladder up to the values of your business. And she had this thing where she spoke about artifacts.
Mm.
And artifacts, like, what is an artifact of a business? If your business has a weekly Zoom call and, I don't know, there's an image of a plant on the person who leads the call, that is a digital artifact of the business.
Mm.
And there are these tiny little examples of that. It could be anything. It could be the coffee cup that you have in the office, like, whatever. These tiny things that you see and do every single day that make up the behaviors of your business.
Mm.
And I love that.
Yeah.
Because I think in this industry, we see so many people using these words to describe what they're doing. And to be honest, they all kind of sound the same.
Mm.
The only difference between your words and your and what you're trying to achieve are your actions. So I love that. Artifacts, big shout out to Sarah Tate.
Love that.
Woody, your second point, or your first point,
mm-hmm.
you mentioned Chris Moody. The headline here is, designers often have a willful naivety about money.
I think sometimes, and I was guilty of this in the past, particularly when I was younger, of a kind of willful naivety to say, well, I don't want to be involved in any of that commercial stuff, because it all feels a little bit kind of grubby and kind of all about the cash. And actually, that's not true. It's about understanding why maybe a client will make a decision. It's about maybe understanding why they would prefer to go with something that might feel less creative, because they're making decisions based on other criteria as well. And it's kind of like, it's like saying, no, it's like reading a book but choosing deliberately not to read the vowels. Right? It's like you can read it and get to the end, but you won't get a full sense of really what the story is. And I always thought it was a really good way to gain knowledge in service of doing more creative.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds quite full on, doesn't it? But I think he's actually talking about the commerciality of design. And he describes his own willful inability to think about, it's like a dirty thing. Designers are like, oh, the money side of things, ops can deal with that. That's all priced up. I just want to do the real creative stuff that, you know, grabs attention. And Chris's point was that if you ignore the commerciality of it, you will ignore why a client makes their decision.
Yes.
And the impact of your work and how that is commercially driven will mean a client is braver or more shy towards pushing the dial.
Yes.
So involving yourself in that conversation is so important, because actually you'll be able to flex your creativity more, or figure out that actually this is as far as we can take it.
Yeah.
And we save that energy for the next client. So yeah, I loved how he described that, because there was a justification to why those decisions, like why that commerciality is so important.
Yeah. That's really similar to James Greenfield.
Mm.
And in my interview with James Greenfield, when I asked him what was the difference between him as design-led creative director and any other, is that he wanted to be the person that was selling the work. And really, once he'd understood the craft of what he did, he wanted to understand how the reason why the work gets killed isn't because of the craft, it's because of the person selling the work.
Mm.
And that person needs to understand the ROI and how to articulate it.
Yeah.
So I want to get fucking amazing at articulating the ROI of great craft and great design.
Yeah.
And not just go, oh, it was more creative than the other ones. Oh my goodness gracious. But that's really cool. I like that. Thank you.
Okay, we're on to
next.
Two for you.
Pacey, baby.
Yeah, we're momentum is going.
Absolutely.
So it's Alex Smith.
Indeed.
No Bullshit Strategy. The market doesn't reward better, it rewards different.
Broadly speaking, the most common form of bad strategies that you have, which is what you alluded to when you were talking about the book before, is any attempt that the company might have to be better than their competitors or to beat their competitors. So let's just say in the car context, someone says, okay, our strategy is to offer outstanding reliability, let's say. Okay, that sounds quite good, sounds quite plausible, I kind of get that. But the problem is that all car companies, give or take, are trying to make reliable cars. And you're saying, okay, well, we're going to make a car that's just a little bit more reliable. Now, the market, even if you succeed in doing that, the market doesn't care. Because the market, it doesn't notice who is slightly better at something or other. The market only notices difference. When you try to be better than someone else on whatever metric it might be, all that actually results in is you and that other company you're competing with becoming more and more similar, because you're each trying to one-up each other at your own game. And over time, what that does is it clusters the market and it commodifies it. So even if you think in the world of like talent, let's say, if you got all of these agencies, let's say, who are just all trying to one-up each other all the time. That means, think about it, if one goes left, the other goes left. If one goes right, the other goes right. They're constantly at each other, not letting each other breathe. Mm. And over time, they become essentially exactly the same business. And then what happens is both of their profits decline.
Massively important.
What is that? Tell me about that.
Okay, so a lot of brands in the world will go out and they'll say, we are the fastest, we are the greatest, we are the whateverest, right? There's that kind of word is called a superlative.
Mm.
And anything that ends in an EST, it's like, it's the key, right? The problem with that is, right, just like Usain Bolt is no longer the fastest man in the world, it's a zero-sum game.
Mm.
So if you are the brand or the business that is saying, we are the EST, that is a time-based goal. And if that's a time-based goal, it's a finite goal. And if your business is based on a finite goal, you're always going to be looking over your shoulder. Either you're competing on lower prices with the cheapest, or you're competing on speed with the fastest. You're almost putting this thing in front of you that's going to be so hard to achieve. And with AI and with everything else coming along, to maintain that is really hard. So much better is to say that we are we're different. We're not even playing in the same game. And Alex speaks eloquently and brilliantly about how the best businesses decide on what they are going to be very good at and very different at, and therefore say no to a lot of the temptation to blend into their competitors.
Mm.
And I've really tried to challenge that with Unknown as well. I've really wanted to make sure that Unknown doesn't fall into this category of being like, we're the best connected creative, you know, whatever, because everyone else can say that and eventually they'll become that too.
Mm.
So I want to make sure that we are only this thing that does this thing, and we are the only X, Y, and Z, because that way we can turn away business. And when you turn away business, it affirms who you really are.
Mm.
It's fucking hard. It's really hard to say, oh, yeah, no, you've got a whole engineering team build. That would be a lot of revenue for our company. But if we say yes to that thing, we end up becoming this blurry, blended business that doesn't stand for anything.
Mm.
So I really believe that different beats better,
yeah,
and that better ends up leading to a zero-sum game.
Yeah. Well, I guess also it's like, we've spoken a lot about this internally, is putting people in the right position
yeah.
to succeed. You know, don't let people bloat into different roles that don't, you know, benefit them. Actually, yeah. What are you truly good at and what do you enjoy? Do that, like, in repetitions and get even better at it,
yeah,
rather than worrying about the other stuff.
Okay, cool. So let's, Woods, your second point.
Mm.
You mentioned, the beautiful man that was Nathan Manu.
Yes.
Beautifully smart
I
as
fell
well.
In love during
We all fell in love, like, with Nathan. The whole team fell in love with Nathan.
Yeah, yeah.
But your point here, so Nathan was a strategy guy? He was from a strategy background?
Yeah, he is a strategist of trade.
Okay, and you've written, when giving the right fucks, you've got to stand up for something.
When there's aggravation or conflict, I think that good things can, as you say, there is beautiful things that can happen in, like, a conflict, because I think you're touching on points that, you know, that need to be spoken about, or that, you know, but I think when there's too much aggravation there, it can cause, like, you know, juts out that don't ultimately create good creative.
But good work needs that. It needs that level of friction.
Yeah.
You know, I still remember, you know, a couple of years ago, you know, our, you know, executive creative director, you know, me and him were in a corner sort of, you know, speaking passionately with each other, trying to crack a big idea for a pitch. Mm. And some other people were a bit concerned about the volume and the way that we were conversing with each other. And he made it pretty clear. He's like, through this conversation, through this interaction, through this passion being exchanged, we are making the work better. Mm. We are getting to a better place.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes it can't just be all sunshine, lollipops and rainbows and always in agreeance. Yes, and yes, being agreeable is important. But, you know, when giving the right fucks, sometimes you got to stand up for something. Standing up for something and ensuring that you're giving the right fucks, sometimes it can cause a little bit of friction.
So this is about the friction in the creative process. And I think that his argument was that he recalled a story about him as head of strategy and the head of design having a really heated, almost argument in the office.
Okay.
Disagreement about a direction. And other people in the office were kind of concerned about what was going on. And the head of design and Nathan agreed that actually this process of friction and disagreement was only enabling that work to become better.
Yeah, nice.
Because they stood and believed in their ideas so strongly that actually to disagree was a positive thing.
Mm.
And so his synopsis of that point is that if you really believe in something and you have put your heart and soul into it, then stand up for it.
Yeah.
And don't be polite about that. You know, be stand up for yourself and your opinions, and that's only going to enable the work and what your impact is to become better.
What's weird about that, and I love that he made that point, is that Polly McMorrow said the same thing.
Mm.
Her thing was really interesting, and that's, funnily enough, is my next person. So we're just
a segue.
That what a segue! What we're a just segue. Gliding straight into Polly. I mean, this is first, perfect. right, the thing that she, there were two things I liked that Polly McMorrow said, but the thing to attach onto what you're saying about Nathan, she believed that people should be okay with standing up for something, and that if you really believe in something, die on the hill. I think, like, COVID, post COVID, everyone had to give a fuck about everything.
Mm.
It was like, I really care about mental health. I really care about it. And, you know, what happened was, because everyone said they cared about everything, working from home, remote working, being in the office, like, nobody stood for anything.
Mm.
And so you just had these really beige opinions that didn't really stand for anything. The work, do you remember the work? Mm-hmm. Like, if you saw an ad on TV, it would be all these weird Zoom videos. Oh, God, someone just say they care. Or actually, and what I like about this is say that you don't care about something, or you care about something more than you care about something else.
Mm.
That's the, I've learned so much from speaking about values. When you do a values exercise as a business and you say, right, let's get in a room and we'll write the words that we really care about, and you get the classic integrity, diversity, hope, you know, it's word bingo. Everyone plays word bingo, yeah, and you get the most important words to the business. The problem with doing that is they generally will be the same words.
Mm.
Where you get to a strong, real value set as a business is by saying, we care about this over that.
Mm.
For us at Unknown, remember when we ditched kindness, right? But we said, actually, accountability matters more than kindness.
And it's kinder to be accountable.
Exactly, to us.
Yeah.
Maybe not to other companies. If we're running a charity, that'd be a bit of a nightmare.
Mm.
But, like, that's what I want, what I take from Nathan, what I take from Polly, is this: back yourself, believe in that thing over something else.
Yeah.
And be okay to say, no, I think that's important, but to me, this is more important than that.
Yeah.
And that's how I think you get really real executions that resonate with people.
Yeah.
Because you've had to pick something over another.
I also think, just to, I love that synopsis, but Americans, or people who work in the American market, are much better at having useful and potentially more amplified disagreements about just general things.
Yes.
You know, having conversations and meeting people in cafes, they'll happily say, I actually don't agree with what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I think this, but that's fine because we are different.
I think it's an optimism thing. Do you know what I mean? I think we're so upset in England in particular. We're so beige. Our opinions are quite like, well, I mean, it could be, it couldn't be. It's like, pick a fucking side.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think in the US, because it's there is a spirit of optimism where...
There is.
I think if you're optimistic, you have a growth mindset. And if you have a growth mindset, you'll get to a solution. And there might be some, you know, trouble on the way to that solution. But if you're both aligned in optimism, we can fall out. And that'll be okay.
Yeah.
It's if you're not optimistic and if you're quite a fixed mindset person and you're fixed to your opinions and you're not open to change, that's when you're going to... nothing great happens with those people, I think. Like, I think that's, yeah. Well, we won't hang on that, but I like that point. Arthur Foyard, who is the CDO over at Koto, he launched Koto New York.
He did.
You've written here, the hardest thing about trying to break into New York is understanding that you're not really needed.
In terms of like your growth, obviously we've spoken a little bit about Koto London or Koto, you know, Koto. How did the New York sort of expansion come around, and why did you choose New York? Why New York?
I think New York makes sense, right? When at least at Koto, we're quite successful in Europe. We have this LA studio that's going really well, and New York is very much a different beast where...
Yeah.
I mean, the competition here is crazy, right? It's so competitive. And it made kind of sense to be here. And personally, in Koto itself, we've always been interested in being challenged, right? Trying to do things a bit differently. And for me, you come here and it's going to be probably the biggest challenge of your life.
Yeah.
It maybe comes back to me personally not thinking that I'm that talented. And it's more effort and effort. I want to learn more and I want to do more. And I'm like... You know, I was very comfortable in London.
Yeah.
I had obviously a good job and a good position. And I'm like, I need to do something else. I need to try something else and to be lost a bit. And also, no one needs you in New York.
Yeah.
Because there's so much amazing studios. I'm sure we'll talk about that at some point. But more, like, you don't matter.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So... Actually, you come in and you feel very humble because it's not because you've been successful in London or LA or Berlin that you're going to be, you know, this big thing. Actually, you need to prove yourself and you need to make a difference.
Mm.
Brutal.
It is brutal. And I think that it's real. And he was it was his first opportunity to launch his own studio, you know, Koto Studio. And I guess you go into that with so much gusto, and ambition, and then you land somewhere and you realise that this is the most competitive market that exists in the whole world.
They say it's like playing against somebody in tennis that's better than you.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that he was really honest. It's like, I quickly realised that we're not needed here. No one asked for us. Actually, people didn't want us to come here in the market. So what do we do to succeed and break through? Yeah. And it was just a painful admission that nobody needs us, so we need to be different.
I love that.
And to be different, we need to not stand for the same stuff that everyone else is. You know, we're a British-founded business who've launched in America when loads of other people have done that. So how do we stand out? And I think what they did really, really well at the start was they took on really non-traditional projects that Koto is known for.
Mm.
And I think that's really interesting. And they're still going. They've hired amazing people.
Yeah.
And they've got a good reputation there now.
Love that.
And yeah.
Weirdly, that point goes back to Alex Noble.
It's almost like we planned this.
It's like we planned this.
It really is.
Oh my goodness. You're not used to this
level. Craig and Stacey.
Indeed.
How the next CEO will be an ex-CMO, not a CFO.
There we are.
What the hell is that about?
I think if Code in Theory is successful in what we are setting out to do, it won't be the CFO that is tapped to be the next generation CEO of Fortune 100's brands and businesses. It'll be CMOs. Right. We won't be having this conversation of, oh, the CIO is the new CMO, because they're just one person. If we do our jobs right, that's one person who is informed with that level of intelligence, that level of understanding of how to set up the technological infrastructure of a company such that their vision can come to life, and has the vision and understands how to execute that vision in culture. CEOs all day.
100%.
Wow. All right, there's a lot of acronyms there. And I promise this will make sense. So Craig and Stacey from Code in Theory, mega smart people. I was a little bit like, I haven't had a two-person interview in a while, so I was quite apprehensive with how that was going to go. They're really hard because they're generally, people are quite polite, and so they let the other person speak. But anyway, Stacey made this incredible point. The next CEOs of the big companies aren't going to be ex-CFOs or ex-COOs. They're going to be ex-CMOs. If what they're doing at Code in Theory and what agencies that are working hard succeed in their mission.
Mm.
So why is that? Why is that a point? Because if you think about it, tech should be a seamless thing. Finance should be a seamless thing. Operations should be a seamless thing. Marketing, if we're living in an attention economy, should be connected to all of those things.
Yeah.
And therefore, you should understand that and understand the rest of the functionings of a business to become the CEO. So the point that they were making is like, you need to understand how the technology works within the business, how the supply chain works within the business, how all of the runnings of the business work, and we'll help you get to that point. But the key thing is, everything is downstream from attention. Your job should be, how do I drive a disproportionate level of attention to this business? And you can't do that without understanding how it works and why it's beneficial. So it was just interesting because I think there's a lot of conversations. Martin Sorrell has been out in the press recently saying that the CMO's role has become easier because of the rise of AI. Fine, that might be the case.
Yeah.
But then everyone's role is becoming easier. So what happens is the tide just rises.
Mm.
That doesn't mean that everyone then gets an easier gig. It means if their job is to stand out as a CMO, if their job is to create attention and get all of the attention, there's only a limited amount of eyeballs on this planet, AI just raises the tide for everyone. So what I like about Code in Theory is they're saying, pay attention to the rest of the runnings of the business, and then you can understand how to be distinctive as a marketer.
Mm.
And the reason why you'll then have to run the company is because you understand the key thing, which is driving attention and driving traffic to the business. Interesting point.
So their argument is that the awareness of a brand from C-suite level is more important than it's ever been.
Yes.
Which is why a CMO whose job is about awareness and getting the brand in front of people
exactly.
is going to elevate and be more important than it ever has.
Absolutely.
Love that.
Indeed. Okay, cool. Moving on to yours, Woody Woodcock. We're now doing Elliot Vredenberg, a CDO unnamed, which you made happen. Talk me through his point here. I love this one.
Mm.
We spoke about this on the way in here. He described product design as a push door and branding as a pull door.
Think like, you know, that's kind of the dichotomy between like what is considered good design, which is supposed to be frictionless, and what is often bad design. Like if you look at a door, there are kind of two ways that you use it. You push it and you pull it. And there are two kinds of handles, one that's designed for pulling, one that's designed for pushing. So whenever you encounter a door with that is a pull door with a pull handle, then that's transparent design. You don't even notice it. Whenever you see a door that has a pull handle and you try and pull it and it's actually a push, then like you have to kind of stop in your tracks and like notice where you're at. And I don't know, I think that ultimately kind of shows that difference between I don't know what I don't know, UI, UX designers do. I mean, good design is great whenever it's used for a specific purpose. But what we do, I think is ultimately would be termed bad design because it's not transparent. It's not frictionless. You're intentionally trying to create that, those like kind of, I don't know, uncomfortable moments.
Yeah, I love this one as well. So the reason why product design is a push door is that product design has to be seamless and frictionless, and you need to be able to pass through digital products without really noticing. That's the art of it, is that you go onto an app and you're like, oh, this is so easy, I've suddenly bought a sofa or whatever it is. And then brand design has to stop you. You have to notice it and stop and pull the door to open it, because distinction is vital for any brand to be noticed or have awareness. Same as campaign really as well, but the art of brand design is stopping people in their tracks and being like, that's a cool thing that I've noticed and I want to know more about it.
I like that.
So yeah, it's quite a nice description.
I love that. Yeah. Thank you so much. Okay, moving. We're getting through these.
We are getting
through
these.
I'm on my last point now, guys.
You are.
Excitingly.
Caroline Johnson.
Oh yeah.
Selling value, not effort.
So let's say I run a company called Marchi and Marchi, and we sell advertising. It's 1980 and we're making a lot of money. Mm-hmm. What happened? Because that was doing very well and publicists would have acquired Marchi and Marchi for a lot of money. Mm. Why is that not possible anymore? And what has happened in the creative commercial landscape to mean that they have to evolve their model? Why can't they just carry on making ads and charging a good amount of money for that?
There are a lot of reasons for that. I think fundamentally what has happened is, as a creative industry, we have started to equate our value not to creativity, but to our effort and to our internal processes and our delivery models. So what has happened is, We've developed a number of services or capabilities. Those services and capabilities are the same as everyone else's. That has allowed the industry to become commoditized. Mm-hmm. So there's very little differentiation when you actually look at what creative agencies are selling. Their superpower, the creativity, has almost become trapped in their effort.
Indeed. So I've had the most amount of feedback on this episode because Caroline, she runs a company called The Business Model Company, and literally her day job is to go into agencies and say, we're going to change how you charge your clients. And in a world where we're seeing margins getting smaller, particularly in creative campaign agencies and branding studios as well, we need to rethink about how we're selling what we're doing. For 65 years, agencies have been selling their time. Mm. Timesheets, and really that's their effort. And we know to become truly successful and build wealth, selling your time again is a zero-sum game, and it ends up becoming to a point where you've like, I've sold all the time I have, either I charge more for this time, like the lawyer effect, and then I become busy. It's that you can't really leverage anything once you've sold your time. The other point you made is that agencies have kind of got themselves into this place of being like an all-you-can-eat buffet.
Where we've got to in terms of how they are differentiating, they're trying to differentiate on what I can call the all-you-can-eat buffet.
Mm.
So the all-you-can-eat buffet is we actually got this idea and concept from the brand and advertiser community. This is how they describe what it feels like to engage with an agency.
Okay.
That they know they are going to be provided with an all-you-can-eat buffet where there really isn't much differentiation between sort of vintage champagne and a white piece of bread and butter. Yeah, it's all on the buffet. And I think the client mentality tends to be, we know we're going to feed ourselves extremely well on that buffet, for a year. And then we'll go and find another buffet, which will be full of wonderful things. That is an issue because we're not packaging up our value against different client challenges and different market challenges that clients have. Mm. Everything is just thrown onto the buffet and clients can feed themselves. So I think the first place to start is to challenge your own assumptions and belief systems and your own culture. Because if you have a embedded service culture, it's going to be extremely difficult to, for example, bring more commerciality, new commercial models, products, programs, to bring those to your service culture. Mm. Because the behaviors and the belief systems haven't changed.
So they offer everything, right? You go, oh, come here, you can eat what you want. It's all free. Just pick up whatever you like. They're like, yeah, yeah. And the client feasts on their all-you-can-eat buffet, demolishing team morale one plate at a time. Mm. And when they're full, they look around and they go, that was delicious. There's another one around the corner. We're going to go over there. And off they go, like, having smashed this agency's margins, having taken everything from them. And the talent probably leaves and moves on as well. Mm. So it's an unsustainable way of running a business. And what I liked about Caroline is that she's looking at creative companies and says, you guys have so many brilliant brains in this business. You've got such value. You're not selling ads. You're not selling branding. You're not selling anything. You're selling value creation. That's what you're doing. So sell value creation in a way that clients can buy it. And so what I love about her is that she looks at the way that clients charge for their projects. She speaks about front doors, how you walk in through the client's front door and how you don't walk out the back door. How do you keep the client in the house? Mm. And then designing different shaped front doors where a client goes, oh, yeah, I can buy that. I can walk through that door. That seems really easy. Mm. So really fascinating episode. And I would implore anyone to listen to Caroline because she speaks a lot of sense and has made a lot of agencies very successful. Mm.
I guess that also leans into why the smaller, more independent agencies are in their tier winning with some clients, because they're offering an exact thing.
Yeah.
And they're not saying they do everything. They're like, we do this thing really, really well. And if you want that, come in.
Exactly.
And if you don't, go to one of these big network places who will service whatever you want.
Exactly.
And eat all the plates.
Which, to be fair, is right for some brands. We're totally not saying that all network agencies aren't right for some places.
Definitely not.
We are not saying that.
No way, Jose.
Whoa. Okay, Woody, your point number four is...
Oh, yes.
Caroline from Koto. Love Caroline.
Love Caroline.
She spoke about how agencies should be speaking earlier about starting families so people aren't acting from a place of fear.
Do you think there's anything that agencies can do to enable someone to come back after sort of maternity leave? Caroline, do you want to?
Yes, for sure. I think, but I think it should start earlier than that. I think it's a very natural thing that a woman and a man, but a woman will get to a certain age and start thinking about family. And the next thought is, well, what about my job? And before they've even become pregnant, it's already on their mind to go, do I stay here? Do I go somewhere else? What's going to happen? And the fear starts to set in, and the concern, and the kind of knock on the confidence. So I think it needs to start at that point, and our language and our support needs to already be in place. And it's much more than just having an amazing maternity package. It's about how we talk about it, how we frame what that maternity package looks like, and how actually, even at the point of getting pregnant, we're already supporting you. Mm. You know, hormones are an amazing thing. And when you're getting pregnant and you're absolutely scared about what that future holds and excited, you need to be helping women through that and taking them on that journey and ensuring that you're giving them the reassurance that not just you're going to support them during that time they're off, and of course their job is open, but actually what does that look like?
So this was on the episode where we talked about the challenges being a female leader in the branding space, and we moved into a territory about starting families, and that's a difficult process. And Caroline mentioned that there is a process of fear which sort of raises within people planning to have children, because even ahead of being getting pregnant, you're terrified about what that means for your job,
yeah,
for your career, for your status within the business, if you're as committed as you once were because you're deciding to move away and start your family and, you know, do normal people stuff. And Caroline's point was that conversations need to be had earlier. You know, it needs to be an open forum within agencies that having a family is normal and doesn't mean that you want to stop working or you don't care about what you do anymore. And I just thought that was really interesting because before that conversation, I hadn't really considered that there's fear that in that sets in when you're like, oh my God, what does this mean? I'm not, you know, and that's even before being pregnant.
So. Yeah.
I just found that an interesting concept.
I think it's a really important one.
Yeah.
It's one that needs to be amplified as loudly as possible because, people... How horrible is that women, and I guess men as well, have to fear having a child, which is literally what we're on this planet to do.
Yeah.
If we didn't do that, everyone would be dead, right?
Yep.
And for some reason, we've not created environments where people feel confident and safe to say, I'm thinking about having a baby. It's not a now thing. It's going to be a 9-month or a year thing. How can I prepare for that?
Yeah.
And am I still allowed to be here? Like, that's fucking wild.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I want to make sure that, you know, we're a small business at Unknown.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make sure, I'm not just saying this to plug our shared parental leave, but it's really important to me that, you know, our key performers and people that we, you know, rely on for revenue generation equally feel very safe in saying that they want to start a family. And the benefit of us knowing as well means that we can prepare and design the workflow streams to make sure that that person doesn't feel like all of their hard work is going to go to nothing. So if we're a 15-person company and we're doing that, I really hope that other companies beyond our size can be doing that as well. Cool. All right. What's our? I finished my points here, so I'll move straight on to your
bonus edition.
Bonus edition point here. Number 5 is Andy Cattulli. I remember this episode hit you, didn't it?
I liked this one. Yeah. This was different. And quite early on, it's quite a long way back, but it was just like pure vibes. The guys were great. It was like we were having a great time, and then we obviously got on to talking about quite serious topics.
And Andy, I'm curious to find out why your definition of why Odigy exists.
Yeah, I think the big thing is representation in positions of influence.
Okay.
So I had my own frustrations kind of coming through the branding agency world and constantly finding myself up against a wall where it felt like there was no one who quite understood where I'd come from, the experiences I had, trying to make myself visible in the industry. I probably had to work two or three times harder than most people who were on my team just because of my background, just because of how my parents came to the UK, because of the struggles of growing up in poverty, access to certain parts of education, the language barrier, like you name it. There were several points in my experience that felt like I was always on the back foot.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big things that were kind of sort of settled on my heart when I came out of university was I really want to make sure that at some point in my career, I can pass this on to someone else. Like I can make it easier for the next person. And so even before me and Matt met, I'd always had this dream of setting up a studio where I could create access for future talent. And it always stuck with me what one of my university lecturers said was that junior talent in the industry are the fresh meat. They're the ones who bring the life to the room. They're the ones who come with the left field suggestions, with innovation, with ideas that no one else has thought of. And I think through my experience of being in the industry, I didn't feel like fresh meat. I felt like a side plate.
Yeah. I can just dive into this one if you want to.
Dive in.
So Andy is a British Iraqi. And when he started in the industry as a brand designer, he was looking around, not seeing anyone who looked like him, had the same experiences with him. He always felt like his back was a bit against the wall because he couldn't really communicate the same challenges as someone else may have faced. So at that point, he'd always wanted to start his own agency. And at the time of recording, Andy had his agency called Odigy. And they were all about kind of amplifying voices of diverse people in the creative industry and giving a springboard to people who'd not had the same experiences as the majority of the design and creative industry. And he mentioned that he wants to be an inspiration for future generations. And that's a lofty sentence, but I love that it's lofty. You know, he's like, I want people who look like me to see, who are starting in the industry, to see someone like me running an agency and think, oh yeah, maybe that can be me one day.
Yeah.
So I love that. And it was like a super cool episode. And I agreed with everything he said. Yeah, and he's a great guy.
He's a lovely guy.
He's a great guy.
He's a really nice guy. Okay, thank you. So look, those were the... I love how quickly we've got through that. And there are so many other things that we could reference that were learnings on that podcast. For anyone that is listening that has recorded a podcast with us, I'm really sorry if we've missed out anything that you said, but we wrote these up very quickly. All right, I want to move on to the second part of this, which is overall... on that mission to kind of give voices to people that perhaps didn't have the platforms or, you know, weren't heard from enough. What have we learned overall? Mm. I think we've covered a lot of the stuff that we've already learned, but I've written three key points. If I can, if you'll indulge me for this one, chip, chop, jabberoo. I've written here, and it refers a little bit to what I just said about Alex Smith, but number one, the first learning that I've had is that innovation and growth can only come if you have a growth mindset. And if you have a growth mindset, what begins to happen is a thing called lateral thinking. And I think lateral thinking is one of the most underrated skills of a human being. My fiance has it. I'm jealous that she has this thing in her brain where I'll just be so habitual in what I do every day. And she'll just be like, why don't you do this? And my whole world will open up to a new array of options. And I think that the industry in particular could take a leaf out of that book. Mm. I think we've been told that we need to be specialists and specialists alone and stay as a specialist forever. But the reality is, yes, do your 10,000 hours. And yes, become a master in something. But when the learning stops and when the earning plateaus... that's when you need to diversify and think laterally. Mm. And you know, that's without overly plugging unknown. That is why we designed this company, because when has there ever been a better time for people to be thinking, I might consider a different part of the industry with my skills. Mm. So, and again, that was why I wanted to make sure the breadth of the people that came onto this podcast weren't just design agency founders. They weren't just creative agency founders and CCOs. They're influencer marketing people. They're brand people. They're working on each element of the industry where there is fulfillment, growth, and wealth at. And so if we can break down those barriers, hopefully, and create more awareness to them, people can have the confidence to say, yeah, I've done my 10,000 hours. Mm-hmm. I heard this podcast about this influencer agency, and I'm going to see if they want to hire an ECD. Whoa. So that was my one point. Innovation and growth comes from lateral thinking. And you can only think laterally if you understand something deeply.
I think also, if you don't mind me bolting on something to that.
Bolt on.
I feel really fortunate that we get to speak to such like a variety of people.
Yeah.
And I think I sometimes forget how important that is to learn things. Mm-hmm. By conversation. I hope that people who have listened to podcasts are like, I've learned something from someone that I'd never have got the opportunity to meet in my day to day.
Yeah.
And I think that's always how I've thought about this podcast.
Yeah.
And how I want it to be in the future is you're actually learning something from someone who is out of your immediate circle of like commercial people that
totally.
You work with every day.
And that was my last point of the learnings, which is... funny, funny segue. And this is going to be so smooth, Nat. You're going to love this. But people digest and learn in a very chaotic and different way. Like, everything's changed. If you think about the basic consumption of you on your phone, 1 minute I'm listening to a 90-minute podcast, the next I'm watching a clip on TikTok, the next I'm reading a post on Medium, the next I'm fucking on LinkedIn, it's been 3 minutes. And I've consumed information from 8 different places. Some of it will stick, some of it won't. And I think there is enough richness of this podcast that will help evolve somebody on. And I love this thinking that we might not be saying new things every day, and we don't really need to. The point is that someone somewhere at some point will hear something that we're saying or our guests are saying, and that will trigger them to move on and do something different. The problem is that not everyone is processing information on 90-minute podcasts. So the key thing is, as we move into the next chapter of this, is to slice, dice, reimagine, and create the content so it lands in front of that one person that makes them have that one piece of inspiration to go and do something a little bit unknown and different. So without further ado, Woody Woodcock, we're closing this chapter.
It's over. It's done.
It's done.
It's done.
It is done, but then we're opening a new one.
What is the new chapter, Ollie Scott?
Thank you. Thank you for asking me. So it's like our philosophy, it's 5 degrees away from what currently was. I think the one element of our last podcast that everybody could say they got was some element of growth. And if I think about what we stand for as a business, we stand for helping talent grow and businesses grow. So I really want to focus our podcast and the conversations and the content that we're creating around growth moments. Growth happens in lots of different ways. You could be growing your profit, your headcount, your skill sets, your knowledge, your anything, your network. So I really want this podcast, Untalented, to reverse its name. I'm going to keep calling it Untalented. But how can I become more talented and growth-focused? By learning about different ways of growing. Growth. So the key thing is that everybody that we're bringing on this podcast is contributing to somebody's growth in some sort of way. We have this really cool idea of taking tiny snippets and focusing it around what that person was contributing to regarding the growth that they're offering, right? So that's the key thing, is that every guest that we bring on will be contributing to someone's career growth or business growth. I've never said growth so many times in my life. We also want more people to discover the potential of this industry. We want more people from tech, finance. I don't want this podcast to be just servicing a niche for the niche to figure out more about the niche. I love that the niche, we need to make sure we're servicing and serving our niche, but I need to make this accessible and digestible for anybody to be listening to this podcast to go, that's really fucking interesting. Because I believe, and I know the stats are saying, the UK alone has a growth of £137 billion in the next year, which outweighs pensions, finance combined. That's how much investment is going into the creative industry. So if that's happening, where are these people, and money's, you know, flooding in, and tech's flooding in, and everything's flooding into the creative industry, where can they go to understand the basics of how this industry works? I want this podcast to be for them as well. So that's the big change. Essentially, prepare for bigger guests, even more de-jargonized conversations, even better conversations that aren't just in long form.
Yeah.
They're going to be in lots of different forms. They're going to be in lots of different platforms. You're hearing this on Spotify and YouTube. You might be seeing this on TikTok or Substack, as Nat's trying to teach me. I'm not sure if you can put videos on Substack. No, you can't, but we will. We will.
Also, we're not going to just be confined to these four walls, right?
No. No offense, outside.
There's going to be, we're going to be out in, you know, different countries, on the street, in offices, all sorts of different stuff. It's going to be a different vibe.
Yeah. We want to become 3D. Like, we're the Simpsons right now. We're in a 2D environment in this freaking on-air sign behind me. We don't live here, people of the podcast. We live everywhere. And we're going to come to a town near you. You know, we've got New York coming up. We've got Cannes coming up. We've got loads of things where we're going to be exposed to brilliant conversations, and we want to use this and mobilize this podcast so it can be more accessible, as you said, on the streets of New York and London and La Croisette.
Yeah.
So yeah, I feel good.
I feel great. I've also loved doing these podcasts.
Yeah.
It was something at the start that I was pretty terrified about, mm-hmm. and I'd never really done before. And I think the richness of some of the conversations, the learnings of the things that we've just discussed, and also really selfishly, I've learned so much about the industry just by being really present in conversation.
Yeah.
And I think that, I don't know, anyone who's listening who has lots of conversations, chuck your phone away, go somewhere where you can actually listen and practice active listening with someone, because you learn so much more than when you've just got that information overload. So I don't know if that's a additional learning that we can add on to the list.
That's a beautiful additional learning. Perfect.
So yeah.
I fucking love this. Thank you so much. Thank you to everyone that's been listening.
Yeah.
Get excited for what's coming next. It's all going to be thanks to Natalie. We won't reveal her surname because we need her to keep on working with us.
Yeah.
And she is unheadhuntable.
Yep.
Thank you very much. And welcome to series 2, Untalented.